Good morning, good afternoon to everyone on today's IRTP call on Tuesday the 17th of August. We have Michaela Nalon, Barry Cobb, Barbara Steele, James Bladel, Paul Diaz, Mike O'Connor, and from staff we have Glenda Saint-Géry, Marika Konings, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Kevin Erdman, Anil George, Bob Mountain, and Simonetta Bottega. So I can please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Michaela.
Hi, everybody. Okay, then. The agenda we have here. Marika will be looking at the comments and everything else. Have you actually posted a review already, Marika?
This is Marika. Yes, I already posted a summary and analysis, which I also circulated to the mailing list, and it's also up in the Adobe Connect now. What I would propose to do, if the working group would think it's helpful, to develop a grid as we've did on previous occasions on the previous public comment round, which basically breaks it down comment by comment and links it then as well to the different parts in the report. That might make it easier for the working group to review the comments in detail. So if that would be helpful, I'm happy to put that together in time for the next call.
Okay, perfect. Does anybody have any problems with that? No? Okay. Mr. Bladel, art thou on the call?
Yes, I am.
Your agenda item number two.
Yes. I posted a message to the list. One of my brief takeaways from last week was to determine whether our internal 60-day lock practice allowed for any scenario in which that could be removed, and I discovered that while it is rare, it is something that we have done.
Could you quantify rare?
No, because that data was not given to me.
Okay. So it could have been a case of 1 in 1,000, or it could have been a case of 1 in 1,000,000.
No, I would say it's probably on the order of, a handful a month.
Right. Okay. Anybody else have anything to bring up in relation to this?
Yeah, Michaela, it's Paul.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to basically back up James's stats. Our experience here at Network Solutions is similar. We will lock a name when we see certain activity on the account. A registrant, the legitimate registrant, is more than welcome to contact us either online or through a toll-free number. And once they've established the bona fides, we will remove that lock. I don't have an exact statistic, but it also is a very infrequent instance where this happens.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any other comments on this? Mikey had circulated something to the list back towards the end of last month, a couple of weeks back. I'll just read for you quickly. Denial reason 7, as currently raised. A domain name was already in lock status, provided that the registrar provides readily accessible and reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. From the initial report, prior to receiving the transfer request, the domain name was locked pursuant... Actually, this is terribly verbose. Now, I think he's raised a couple of queries. Here we go. Should we limit this only to locks imposed by registered name holders? Michael Collins suggested this, but my recollection is that this policy is really aimed at both registrant-initiated and registrar-initiated locks. So if we want, we can explore moving the treatment of registrar-initiated locks to issue D. But then Mikey says he's going to be grumpy, and we wouldn't want that. How can we address Paul's point that overly detailed publishing security practices provide a roadmap to criminals? Is the 5-day interval the right one? I think that's the main key point. Is there anything else that you wanted to add in, Mikey?
No, that's that's the list, and I don't recall any subsequent conversation on the list about it, but I have been distracted, so I could be wrong on that.
Okay. I see James has got his hand up.
Yeah, just, and I wanted to thank Mikey for putting this together, but, you know, on this particular issue and the task of redefining this reason for denial, I'm very concerned that we're taking something that has, you know, what, maybe 12 to 15 words and is causing confusion, and we're turning it into several paragraphs. And I'm concerned that we may be unintentionally creating or worsening the problem of confusion, ambiguity, and non-uniform interpretation of this reason for denial. So I'd like to maybe just put it out there for discussion of is this clarification something we really want to pursue? Can we do it incrementally? Does it need to be broken up into multiple reasons for denial rather than try to be, you know, as Mikey has tried to unpack this? Do we need to, are we trying to do too much with this language?
I'm just going to put myself in the queue. Just from my own perspective, just speaking as myself, I would like to see this be clearer in some respects. So I think there is a bit, parts of the language here is in need of clarification. Now, whether that means that it's simply an add-on paragraph or whether people need to look at breaking it up a bit more, I don't have any strong feelings either one way or the other. Mikey?
I hate to drag us all the way back in time, but this was one of the issues that we inherited from the distant past, and I think we, you know, this is one of the ones I think we have to resolve, James. I don't think we have a choice on this one, and it's because the language just isn't clear. We had a drafting group that sort of took a look at some of this stuff, and we didn't, in the drafting group, feel that we had the charter to take this on, and so we booted it down the line to here. So to boot it down the line again, I think then puts us out, I mean, I think we're talking a 5-year interval here. So I think this is one that's on our plate that we have to fix. I don't, like McKaylee, I don't have real strong opinions about how we fix it, but I'm pretty uncomfortable kicking the can again.
McKaylee, can I respond?
Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's fine, Mikey, and that's fair enough. You know, perhaps if we take a look at your unpacked version, if we were to look at that as reason for denial 7A through 7C or something like that. I mean, I hate to get this even more convoluted, but, you know, it's fair if we believe that we have to do something to fix this. I just want to make sure we don't make it worse.
Let me just jump in, McKay. I agree. I think that, you know, the main issue is whether we tackle it, not how. I think there are a lot of different ways that we could do this, and I agree with the notion that our goal is to make it clearer, not more murky, for sure. And, you know, the reason I did the unpacking was just to sort of get us started down that line. And then, you know, Michael Collins raises, you know, an interesting point, which is the difference between registrant-initiated and registrar-initiated locks, and we'd really have to go into the misty past, but I believe that the focus of this particular confusion was registrar-initiated locks. We'd have to do some digging to make sure on that. But, I just think we need to get this one figured out and fixed.
Marika, and then Paul.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to mention that one of the public comments submitted by the registry stakeholder group, they've actually submitted another proposal on how to modify this language. So maybe the working group at some point might want to consider that in conjunction with the discussion on the proposed language or as it has been broken down by Nike.
Could you dig out the link for that, please, Marika? We can paste it on the chat or something. Dig up the language.
Yes, I'll dig out the comment and post it. I think it actually is probably, maybe it's easier if I actually pull it up in Adobe Connect because I think it's probably an attachment that they provided. So if you give me a couple of seconds.
No problem. Mr. Diaz.
Yeah, thanks, Michele. Please pull it up, Marika, because as I recall, the registry's proposed language led us down this path of going from 12 words to 14 paragraphs. The language was even more confusing, so we definitely need to see it. My point for all of this, though, guys, is I'm not sure if I'm agreeing or disagreeing with you all. What I can't get my head around is what is the problem? What do people want to see clarified? Yes, Mikey's correct in that these charter questions were originally formed by a working group that literally did its work 5 years ago. The marketplace has changed dramatically over time, over that period of time. So, when we start agonizing about was it registrar or registrant-initiated locks, look, to me, I don't think that really matters. The reality of the world we face today is that almost all registrars lock names as a default security measure. So let's just kind of accept the reality for what it is and then look at the language and say, what is it about the text that we have right now, the existing language that is confusing to folks? And if it's confusing, fine, then let's do it. But these kind of murky, we ought to do something, I'm not sure exactly what, I don't get what it is we're trying to do here or where we're going. I mean, I look at the language and I see it as pretty self-evident. Personally, I don't believe that the working group needs to recommend any language changes. I'm perfectly open if somebody can make a good argument about what is confusing. But let's just make those arguments and stop kind of spinning our wheels about was it registrars or registrants. And it is what it is. Everybody uses locks. The language that we have, is it clear enough so that the typical user can understand what needs to be done to have that lock removed so they can move forward on the transfer request, and then that's enough. I think in too many ways this working group is making, whether it's with our ETRP proposal or other things, a lot more work for ourselves than we need to do on this particular PDP.
Thanks, Paul. I put myself in the queue. I mean, the thing I was... of the understanding was that there was some confusion being caused by this, which was why it was something that was still coming up. From my own personal reading of this, I think part of the issue was in relation to readily accessible and reasonable. It wasn't clear to people, and there was some difference of opinion about that. Marika, I think you said to me offline that you were going to just double check with compliance to see if this was something that they had been tracking.
Yeah, this is Marika. I suggest indeed that, as Paul mentioned, that this is an issue that was raised 5 years ago. I'm happy to go back to check with our compliance team and as well our legal department whether they see this as an area where it would be helpful to have a clarification or whether indeed it's no longer an issue because, events have already taken over whatever confusion that might have existed around certain terms. So I'm happy to check internally as well what the view is there if people would like.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to probably make a very strange sound because my headset battery is about to die, so please don't feel that I'm ignoring you all. I might end up going offline and coming back on again. Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, basically, just from the registry stakeholder group perspective, if I can just add a little bit of background surrounding it, I think that, you know, primarily the group wanted to be supportive of registrars being able to put in place products to secure domain names. I think that we all recognize the value of being able to protect high-value domain names. So I think that the only point that the stakeholder group, the registry stakeholder group, was really trying to make here is that, you know, so long as the registrars and their agreements with the registrants, you know, make it clear that they're, you know, what their practices are, then, you know, we're supportive of them being able to do that and just basically be able to go forward with various products and services to secure domain names, because we do recognize the value in that.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
Ooh, you are making strange noises. Are you on a speakerphone or something?
I am temporarily. I'm going to switch myself.
Oh, okay. Ooh, nice echo. Oh, that's better. You know, I think from the registrant perspective, that would be me. The reason I'm interested in this issue is because I want to make sure that when I want to transfer a name, I can, and that the mechanism to remove any locks is clear. And I think you're right, McKaylee. The big issue is readily accessible. And a lot of times, at least out in the world, the story is that sometimes these things aren't readily accessible and that we need to set some standards for that. So, sorry, James, to be in your face, and Paul, but you know, this is basically, I think, a tussle between registrants and registrars, and we're just going to have to tussle it out.
I see Paul putting something there on the chat.
But can I respond to
go ahead.
To Mikey's? You know, Mikey, I think we're going to have a situation like you know, you and I and others experience in all these various working groups where you know, they're a large number of registrars that do everything the way you would expect. As a registrant, you would expect things to be done. They do provide readily accessible and reasonable means, and you don't have a problem with it. The challenge will be those registrars who are not. But we have the same problem like we see in other working groups now. Can you point to a registrar who is not providing a readily accessible, reasonable means? If not, we get into the all too common dilemma where we have anecdotes that are driving policy, and again, from my registrar's perspective, we are trying to fix existing policy that is not broken in our view. We provide readily accessible and reasonable means. Nobody complains about them, so we don't see a problem. We would like to move on. If you can demonstrate a harm, if you can show us a registrar so that we have a concrete example of what is an unreasonable practice, great, then let's tighten the language and focus around that. Otherwise, I really can't support trying to create a fix to a policy that in our view is not broken.
Let me just respond to that. You know, I think that I'm becoming impatient with that argument, Paul. I mean, you know, I'm a volunteer. I don't have a professional staff to back me up. I don't have the time to chase around and find these examples. But at the same time, I think that registrants are owed a certain level of protection. And so I think we have to get past this sort of kabuki theater ritual dance and figure out a way to solve problems like this. I don't know if it means that
that's fair, Mikey, but
to,
with the existing...
I can and ask for a professional staff allocation to support volunteers like me, but, you know, I'm not the guy to ask for that, because I participate with two registrars and both of you are on the call. So, you know, give me a break. You
I understand know, that, Mikey. Look,
this was an issue that precedes my involvement in ICANN. It was clearly something that was on the minds of a group of people 5 years ago, and I think to just shrug our shoulders and say, well, it's not a problem anymore, is not satisfactory.
One more follow-up, Michele?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. True, Mikey, and I'm not asking you, certainly yourself is a great example as a volunteer who contributes a lot of his time to this, to go out. But, you know, you sort of made my point for me. Your experience, the registrars you deal with, you don't have a problem. If you had had a name with somebody and had a problem, you could say, hey, XYZ gave me a hard time, and then we would have something to go on. What I'm suggesting again is that if we can't demonstrate the problem, then this becomes a ICANN compliance issue, because the text that exists, the policy text that exists, to me is pretty damn clear. And if somebody, if registrants have a problem with it, they contact compliance and say, you guys have to work with this registrar, get on their case, because they are not providing readily accessible, reasonable means. I don't think that this PDP, in the absence of a demonstrated harm of somebody specific who is doing it wrong, should start trying to figure out, well, we've heard about these problems happening elsewhere, and we're, you know, kind of blindly going off creating a fix to something that we think is happening out there.
Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just want to reiterate something I think that was raised in the past by some of my compliance colleagues, but indeed the language as it currently stands isn't easily enforceable because there is no definition of what reasonable and accessible means. So it's very difficult to tell someone, well, it's not reasonable and it's not accessible because there's no definition. I think what was suggested by them would be helpful, for example, if certain examples would be provided. If the language would indicate, you know, that 5 days is considered reasonable, well, anyone who, you know, allows for 10 or 20 days could be considered unreasonable. So, and I think it's something, you know, we've discussed before, that maybe a line of thinking would be to maybe include some examples to give an indication of what is considered. And, of course, and there's still some margin, but at least that would give the compliance team something to work with, you know, when looking at different practices.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to read a couple of things from a couple people from the chat, because I think Rob Golding is only in via chat. He's not actually on the call. Just a few minutes ago, Paul Diaz mentioned that readily accessible and reasonable is a US-centric legal construct. It's intended to allow some wiggle room. I not be overly prescriptive. But hold registrars to a standard the industry considers the norm. Rob Golding, following up from that, goes, affords the registrars the flexibility about putting some reasonable requirements around the locking. Are we going to agree a best practice that details the locks are clearly published in non-legalese and the reasons for the lock, how long it lasts, and how to remove it are shown in the terms and conditions before applying it or accepting the registration? Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I've just been off the call a couple of minutes, and that was because I walked across the room and I've asked one of our chaps, have we ever known a problem where, with the transfer, whether a registrar hasn't been willing to unlock, and he's actually reported no. We have plenty of problems because the client's got confused with the authorization code and things like that, and it's expired, but never because the registrar just didn't want to unlock it. So it looks like we might have to try and dig for some evidence on this, yeah?
Okay. James?
Hi, Michele. Thanks, James. And real quickly, I just kind of want to jump into the love-in between Paul and Mikey and wade into that against both sides to some extent. You know, I agree with Paul specifically that, you know, there's a lot of PDPs or policy initiatives being kicked off based on, you know, undocumented or unquantifiable problems that need to be solved. And I think this is a real issue within ICANN because once you're not able to define a problem, then how do you know if the policy that you've put forth actually goes any length towards solving it? And I think that, you know, we're getting to a point here where we're cranking out PDPs and initiating working groups based on the power of individuals in various corners to persuade others to support a problem. So I completely understand where he's coming from on that. However, I'm going to disagree with him a little bit, maybe take Mikey's side. in saying that this is already an existing policy. So to some extent, that argument, while valid, doesn't fully apply here. And I think that, you know, clarifying or tightening up an existing policy that the good guy registrars like myself and like Paul and like everybody else on this call and an ICANN were already abiding by reason for denial 7. We just need to make sure that what it is that we're agreeing to and operating under is universally or uniformly understood and is not open to interpretation. And that's where I jump into this idea that I'm concerned that we're taking a loophole here. If reason for denial 7 has some ambiguity, we're taking a loophole and we're turning it into, a floodgate. And I'm concerned that the bad guy registrars who may be abusing or misapplying reason for denial 7 today will have a field day with some of this new language. But my recommendation at this point, rather than, you know, continuing to circle around the issue or do the kabuki dance, as Mikey said, is to maybe draw some boundaries around what it is we're trying to do and put together some language that we're hoping will tighten this up. If we can't pack it all into the reason for denial sentence and move it out into an appendix to IRPP, move it into a definition section, or something to close loopholes and close ambiguity, as opposed to throwing it wide open.
And just coming back on a bit of this, just one thing in relation to this entire discussion. If you remember several months ago, David Giza shared with us some of the statistics in relation to the complaints that ICANN Compliance had received at the time. There were several of them which were related specifically to the registrar not refusing to unlock the domain name. Now, obviously, we'd no visibility on what happened afterwards, but just looking at one of the spreadsheets that David had sent out, the failure to unlock domain by registrar column appears quite often. Marika, what do you think the likelihood of you getting something back from compliance for next week's meeting is like?
This is Marika. I know several people have been on holiday or are on holiday, so I cannot guarantee it, but I'll do my best.
Okay, thanks. Right, any other issues or any other matters in relation to this? Oh, James?
Yeah, what's our path forward, I guess?
Personally, I'd like to have some input from compliance on this. That's my own personal view. I think if compliance and other members of ICANN staff, ICANN staff have made proposals in the past in relation to various different things based on the issues that have been raised with them through various different contexts. So while I appreciate where Paul's comments are coming from, and yes, whoever is typing, would you please put yourself on mute? I appreciate where Paul's comments are coming from. I'd also agree quite strongly with Mikey in some areas of this. You know, it's not something that kind of came out of nowhere. In our own experience, we've seen registrars, and specific registrars, using locks in manners that we would consider to be unreasonable. For example, charging registrants 2 to 3 times the annual registration fee to remove the lock. Now, I don't know, would Paul consider that to be reasonable?
I'm sorry, charging a fee to remove the lock?
Yes, 2 to 3 times.
That's explicitly not allowed.
Where is it explicitly not allowed?
We've had through very recent experience with a reseller who was doing that, somebody complained to compliance. Compliance came back and said, no can do. So I shouldn't use the word explicit. I don't know its policy, but compliance has explicitly told us, go tell your reseller that's not acceptable.
Now, we've had experience of that, and I have actual screenshots of invoices and everything else where one registrar was actually charging, I think, about €15 to unlock a .com.
Yeah, but that gets back to my point that that registrant should contact compliance, and compliance will come back and say, you can't do that, that's a violation of your of the RAA.
Yeah, but where in the RAA does it specify it? That's the problem.
I don't know, and I agree. It's a shame that David's not here because doesn't seem anybody else from compliance is on the call, but I'm sure they could answer it because they are sending out those sorts of letters.
Right. Well, I might follow up with you directly on this afterwards if you don't mind. I mean, the thing from my perspective is that our customer service staff have had to escalate things to me personally in the past because particular registrars or their resellers have either refused to unlock domains or have tried to levy fees on this. So I think it's something that we can't fully ignore. However, we'll wait to see what Marika comes back with next week. With respect to the summary of the comments, have any of you had a chance to read over it? Yes? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just want to emphasize again that, you know, this is a summary that I've prepared based on, you know, what I've read in the comments and what I thought was important for the group to consider. But I really would like to encourage everyone to review the comments submitted in their entirety because, you know, I might have missed things or I might have not picked up on certain nuances that others deem important for the discussions in the working group. So, you know, for the discussions going forward, I just hope that everyone will have a chance to review all the comments in detail and point out where anything in the summary, you know, might have been missed or might be important for the working group to take into account in their further deliberations.
Okay, thanks. Does anybody have any strong feelings or anything on this at the moment? Because I think it would be possibly more constructive for us to look at the kind of matrix type thing that Marika is going to be preparing for us. And we can actually work a bit more productively based on that. Does anybody have any other comments to make at this time? Or does anybody object if I call this to an end and based on us dealing with this next week? No? Okay. So I will adjourn then till next week when we'll hopefully have the matrix and we're going to work our way through that. Okay? Deathly silence.
That sounds good, McKelly.
Okay. All right. Talk to you all next week then.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.